You are listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, December 7th, 2008, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
You probably noticed the similar words in the Mark passage, verse 3, and in the Isaiah passage, verse 3. The voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. And that's probably why these two passages were put together in the lectionary for today. Both are talking about a new time, a change, themes we like to think about in Advent. And as Rosie said, chapter 40 of Isaiah begins with the familiar words from Handel's Messiah, comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Why is there this call for comforting, and who is it that needs comfort? And if we go back to chapter 39 of Isaiah, to get the context, it doesn't really work, but it's interesting. Instead of the poetry of Isaiah 40, we find a story there, and it's the story of Judah's King Hezekiah. And the country has been spared an invasion by Assyria because somehow, suddenly, a lot of the potential invaders got the flu or something. It was pretty deadly, so they ran back to, the ones that were still alive ran back to their country, and the invasion didn't happen. So there was an interval of peace, relative peace. And during that time, an envoy from an up-and-coming kingdom, Babylon, came and visited. And Hezekiah was very happy to show off all his silver and gold and his latest technology and his military equipment. Now, the prophet Isaiah wasn't very impressed with this showing off of all the treasures, and he told Hezekiah that eventually all these things would be carried off to Babylon, and that in the future Hezekiah's descendants would become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Now, Hezekiah's response was a little inscrutable. He said, "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good." For he was thinking, there'll be peace and security in my lifetime. And Hezekiah didn't, he isn't the one who needed the comfort. He felt pretty comfortable with his own life being fine, with little regard for those coming after him. And there's maybe a little lesson there for us. But the information on who the comfort is for comes in verse 2 of Isaiah. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Now, we might like to grab that comfort in verse 1 of Isaiah for ourselves during Advent, but it's really intended for Jerusalem. And it turned out that everything Isaiah said happened, maybe even worse things. As in the days of John the Baptist, this is an announcement in Isaiah of a new time, a time of change, a change for the better. In October, I had the opportunity to hear Walter Brueggemann give two lectures at Regent College, and one of the lectures was on Isaiah. And he mentioned that between chapter 39 and chapter 40, there's a 160-year gap. This is when the residents of Jerusalem underwent exile, and there was a siege, maybe a couple of sieges, I don't know. Brueggemann said that the book of Lamentations fits into this gap. So although Lamentations is not part of the lectionary for today, I decided I would delve into it as a background for Isaiah 40. Lamentations, like much of Isaiah, is poetry, and each chapter, there are five chapters. Each chapter is an acrostic, and each verse is, there are 22 verses in each chapter, and each verse begins with a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet, like A, B, C, so on in Hebrew, but I don't know what those are. The exception is chapter 3, which has 66 verses, and so it groups three verses for each letter. And chapters 1 and 2, the ones I'm going to concentrate on today, form a sort of unity, and the other chapters have other voices. And the features of using this kind of format for the book is that it puts boundaries on what is said, puts boundaries on the expression as to fit the form, but it also opens up possibilities for all kinds of metaphors and ambiguity. And except for a few verses in the middle chapter, which you'll hear at Advent Vespers tonight if you go, this book is all lamentations, all complaints, and the voice of God is absent. There are two voices in chapters 1 and 2, as you heard them read. One is the narrator, and the other is a feminine voice, Daughter Zion, or Jerusalem. Now, did you get tired hearing that reading? It was pretty long, and I even had some verses skipped out in chapter 2. Have you ever had the experience of listening to someone who ranted in a similar manner? There are several troubling ideas in these two chapters, and I've got about five of them here. I'll name them, and then I'll go on to talk about them. The first one is the downplaying of the admission of sin. The second is the idea that God is an abuser. The third is the severity of the punishment. The fourth is the call to punish the enemies. And the fifth is the lack of response from God. So the first one, the downplaying of the admission of sin. Lamentations is not about somebody browbeating themselves because of all their sins. That there were sins that led to a punishment, it's mentioned, but it's downplayed. And it happens, I've got in my text here, only in the first chapter, but I realized when chapter 2 was read, there's one little mention there of iniquity. So in chapter 1, twice the narrator mentions this, verse 5, the Lord has made her suffer for the multitude of her transgressions. In verse 8, Jerusalem sinned grievously. And then four times, Daughter Zion speaks of it in chapter 1. Verse 14, my transgressions were bound into a yoke. Verse 18, I have rebelled against his word. Verse 20, I've been very rebellious. And verse 22, all my transgressions. And after this, there's no more mention of sin except that one verse of iniquity in chapter 2. And the two verses, the two references to rebellion could have been read differently. In Hebrew, rebel is M-R-H, and bitter is M-R-R, so they differ by one letter. And this idea of bitter is the same bitter that describes Naomi, who was embittered by the loss of her husband and son. So a transcriber could have changed that there, but who knows? Who knows if that happened? The allusion to sin could also have been coerced, or you can imagine that it would have been stated in a kind of satirical manner, like, my transgressions? You can almost hear that. In any case, no mention is made of what these sins were, or if they occurred before or after the suffering began. Now, if children were eaten, was that after the siege, when people were desperate? If prophets were false and worthless, was it after the scriptures were taken away? We don't really know. We do know that the suffering was terrible, and that's what comes through more than the sin. Now, the second point, the idea that God is an abuser. Now, that may sound like very strong language, but here are the verses that I'm getting that from. In chapter 1, verse 5, the Lord has made her suffer. In verse 12, the sorrow which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. Verse 13, he sent fire. He spread a net for my feet. He's left me stunned. Verse 15, he rejected all my warriors in the midst of me. He proclaimed a time against me to crush my young men. The Lord has trodden as in a wine press, the virgin daughter of Judah. Verse 17, the Lord has commanded against Jacob and his neighbor that his neighbors should become his foes. And chapter 2, the Lord has become like an enemy, or it could be, as one commentator suggested, exactly like an enemy. Verse 6, he has destroyed his tabernacle. The Lord has abolished in Zion festival and Sabbath, and in his fierce indignation has spurned king and priest. 21, on the day of your anger, you have killed them, slaughtering without mercy. And in verse 22, on the day of the anger of the Lord, no one escaped or survived. Those whom I bore and reared, my enemy has destroyed. And the enemy in this verse doesn't refer to some other power coming in and doing that, but it refers to God. And there were more verses in chapter 2, in case you need more evidence. You can go and read the whole thing. So both the narrator and daughter Zion put a lot of blame on God for the punishment. And there's very little in the text to contradict that. Now, the third one is the severity of the punishment. Verse 12, we heard those familiar words, "Is there any sorrow like my sorrow?" And the narrator tries to get at something in verse 13 of chapter 2. "What can I say for you? To what compare you, O daughter of Jerusalem? To what can I liken you that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter Zion? For vast as the sea is your ruin." And I think the narrator is trying to get at the idea of infinity there, the vastness without measure. In addition to the physical suffering, daughter Zion repeatedly complains that there's no one to comfort her. And the narrator repeats that several times. So there are two things going on here. There's agony and there's no support. And now the fourth one is the call to punish the enemies. And this comes at the end of chapter 1 when daughter Zion asks that her enemies become like her and that God deal with them as he has dealt with her. Now, we've heard this idea expressed before in the Bible. It comes through in some of the Psalms. We don't always read those parts of those Psalms. So I'm not going to dwell further on it here. It's not an idea we find in the New Testament. In fact, we find something quite the opposite. Fifth, maybe problem in these passages is the lack of response from God. So there's one positive phrase about God by daughter Zion in chapter 1, in verse 18. "The Lord is in the right." But nothing is heard from God, good or bad. Now this silence, this is true for the whole book of Lamentations. This silence gives more prominence to the voice of the narrator, who is increasingly on the side of daughter Zion, even if unable to offer much help. And it gives prominence to the voice of daughter Zion. Their voices really stand out. That's what you hear. And the book of Lamentations is even more one-sided than the book of Job, where there is a response from God. And because there's no response from God, we're left with hanging with a lot of shocking negativity about the nature of the divine being. But if we don't stop there, if we go on to Isaiah with chapter 40, we're not left hanging. We have a response offering comfort and a new day, a new time. And the whole rest of Isaiah is a response to this agony of Lamentations. And there's even a concession of God in chapter 54 of Isaiah, verse 7. "In a surge of anger, I hid my face from you for a moment." At the moment, seems not very descriptive. In the second part of Isaiah, God is on the defensive and attempts to shore up the relationship with daughter Zion. And the response in Isaiah 40 admits that the punishment was too severe, too overdone, or at least it was double. She has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. And the double idea also comes across in the repetition, "Comfort, O comfort." The repetition there. Now the double idea could refer simply to the extent of the suffering, but it could refer to the fact that there was no one to comfort. Because there was no response from God, it ended up being both a physical and a spiritual suffering, a double whammy. And if you still feel that there's an imbalance with the Lamentations account, go to Ezekiel, Hosea, and Jeremiah. There, they have little room for voices other than God's and the prophets. Ezekiel 16 is so abusive to daughter Zion that it is wrenching to read. In the prophetic books, the marriage metaphor with divorce is often used, and it can become too vivid. taking the prophetic books together with Lamentations, there is some balance then. Lamentations does not emphasize the marriage metaphor as much as some of the other books, but it emphasizes more daughter Zion being a mother and a nurturer. She's very concerned for the people, the old and the young. And the narrator takes on her concern when he mentions in verse 12 of chapter 2 this image of suckling infants' lives poured out on their mother's bosom. Is it worthwhile to have a book like Lamentations in the Bible? I'd like to answer yes and give, I've got three reasons here. Well, the first one is just historically it's useful because it fills the gap between Isaiah 39 and 40. It helps us understand the book. And Brueggemann said, roughly speaking, Isaiah 1 to 39 is a book of judgment or coming judgments, whatever. And Isaiah, the rest of the book from chapter 40 to 66, is a book of grace. The second reason is in Lamentations we hear the voice of suffering. I don't think anyone can argue with that. The voice asks us to look on my affliction, look and see if there's any sorrow like my sorrow. And the narrator even tells daughter Zion to cry out. Now, it's not pleasant to hear the voice of suffering. It can seem too strident. It's tiring. But as we read the Bible, we're forced to come across the voice of suffering. For some of us at one time or another, this might be our own voice. If it's not our own voice, do we think that we're entitled to be spared hearing this kind of voice? And the third reason, what I think Lamentations is good to have there and look at from time to time, is that it helps us understand that life is complex, that there are no simple answers, at least where suffering is concerned. When we finish reading Lamentations, we're left with the concept that God punishes, that it was God's fault in many ways. The old question of God's role in suffering is really brought to our attention. The question of our role in suffering comes up. What did we do wrong? What should we think when we or others suffer? The answers aren't really given in that book. The suffering in Lamentations is what one commentator called radical suffering. And some examples today would be Africans who are poor, losing their land, being raped, getting AIDS, and becoming refugees and then starving. Another example is the Russian Mennonites who suffered through famine, had what food they did have stolen, got fatal illnesses, and had family members taken to the gulag. A third example could be native children taken away from their parents and culture, forbidden to speak their own language, and then abused by their teachers. Now, if these suffering ones expressed themselves, they might sound a lot like daughter Zion in Lamentations. The early Anabaptists I read recently were criticized for a number of things, and one of them was that they did not use the Old Testament. They liked to use just the New Testament and the Psalms. And the Reformers disagreed with them, saying that it's the same God in the Old and the New Testament. So perhaps we should have stuck with our Anabaptist roots and not gone back to Isaiah and Lamentations and all that negative history. But it's my view that going back to the Old Testament helps understand the New Testament, and I think it helps us understand John the Baptist's message and Jesus' message better. In Mark 1:15, we have a very short summary of Jesus' message. The time is fulfilled. The kingdom of God has come near. Repent and believe in the good news. Both John the Baptist and Jesus are talking about embarking on a new time, similar to what is going on in Isaiah 40. God is not hiding his face. It's quite the opposite. Jerusalem has served her term. That's over. The glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together. God will reveal himself as both mighty and tender. The coming of Jesus is an action on the part of the divine to show his presence eternally. The kingdom of God is near. There will be no more hiding of face. Even the fierce anger is a thing of the past. Instead, love and good news prevail. I'd like to close with words of Jesus in John 17:26. I have made you known to them and will continue to make you known in order that the love you have for me may be in them and that I myself may be in them.